Okay, so thank you for the invitation to speak. My talk is really going to be sort of a commentary on the previous talk, an addendum to it or something like that. It's based on joint work with Nilou for Coldown, who was not able to come. So I'm sort of giving her talk. So the matrix norms are the ones that Marius was just talking about. So just to remind you again what the story is, we're looking at a non-commutative version of this LQ of LP norm. The LQ of LP norm of a sequence like this just means sort of taking the taking the P norm sort of over the second index there, and then take the Q norm of that, so you get this, and that's the thing that we want to find a non-commutative version of. So non-commutative version in the non-commutative version we apply it to, instead of a biindex sequence here, we apply it to a matrix, say Y, which is in a bipartite space. So it's in matrices from CN tensors CM into itself. So we can think of it as a block matrix, say an N by N block matrix, and each block is itself an M by M matrix. So in the diagonal case, the diagonal entries are exactly a sequence like that, and then you have this as your definition of the norm. So the question is, what do you do with a block matrix where you have something like this? Okay, so each of the entries is itself a matrix. Okay, so the solution to this was provided by the work of, as Marius said, by the PZA and himself, Junge. And so the definition of the norm is sort of a souped-up Hagerup norm. So you define an index R by taking 1 over P minus 1 over Q, and you do it in whichever order gives you something positive. And then for Q less than P, the norm is defined by an infimum where we take a decomposition of the original matrix Y in terms of these strange looking things here. Okay, so this sort of idea of taking an inf of a sum of norms is the Hagerup norm. This particular decomposition here is the ingredient which makes it work and which comes out of the work of PZA. Any other?
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Summon's not necessary.
Okay, great.
And that's exactly what you said. It comes from the Hagerup norm.
Okay. I think what I'd say to that is that the nice point about using the sum here is that it allows the nice properties of the norm to be proved from first principles, elementary means. And that's and that's a nice feature of it. So for that reason, I'm going to stick with it. Okay. What? Sorry. This is the disadvantage of using Stone Age technology. Okay. So that's the definition in the one case, and then the definition in the other case where Q is bigger than or equal to P is given by the soup, something that looks more reasonable in a sense. You take an entity tensor Y, and you take the P norm, and then divide by the R norms of A and B. Okay? So that kind of looks like somewhat more familiar way of getting a norm. Okay, so it turns out that this is the right way to do it, and the reason that one can say that with confidence is because it satisfies the properties that you would want to have for an extension of an LP norm. In particular, it satisfies duality, which says that the, let me put in subscripts now, the PQ norm, with this definition, depending upon the size of P and Q, is equal to the trace soup of the trace of Y times W, where you soup over matrices that satisfy this. And these are exactly the conjugate indices for P and Q. Okay? So that's it, I would say. That's the advertisement for why this is the right definition to use. And then in addition, it also does what it should do. For example, if you take a tensor product and this PQ norm, then you get the product of the, I guess, Q, it's Q on the outside and P on the inside, so you get this. Okay, so that's also something you would like. And it also reduces to that formula if you have a diagonal matrix. Okay. So that's it. So, okay, so what's the question or what's the problem? Well, as Mario said a few times, how on earth do you got all these soups and ints, so how do you calculate this thing? And that certainly isn't obvious. So for that reason, it's nice to try to find some ways of estimating it or bounding it. And in that regard, there's sort of a very natural candidate for something that you would like to use. Because if you just look at that, then the obvious thing way to generalize that is to use partial traces in terms instead of those sums, and to just look at this. This is certainly an obvious candidate. In fact, if you were just asked the question, find an extension of that norm to the non-commutative case, you would write this down, and then you stare at it, okay? So that would be your sort of guess, you know, why doesn't that work? Well, this actually fails for a very simple, well, I mean, this fails for a very basic reason, which is that this operation of taking the absolute value isn't operator convex, so you don't get a triangle inequality. Okay. So this does not define a norm. However, you can still ask, is it useful for estimating this? So the answer is that it is. So okay, so let me just look first at the case where y is positive. So for a positive semi-definite matrix on this bipartite space, so this whole block matrix itself is a positive semi-definite matrix considered in the product space. The PZA norm is less than or equal to this thing here. So this thing again, especially with the infimum, is extremely hard to see how you calculate that. Whereas this now, you can just write it down. So it gives a useful bound for it. Just to say a word about why this result holds. If we take the case where let's take the case where Q is bigger than P, so we have the soup expression over there, then since Y is positive semi-definite, it's quite easy to see that you can evaluate this by restricting to positive semi-definite matrices. And you can put that, you can put A equal to B, so you sort of get this kind of expression here. Okay, that's an easy exercise. And then you can play a trick here, which is that you can sort of define a new matrix C by taking your matrix A there and just scaling. I'm sorry, take A to the take A to the 2R, where R is that index that appears there, and then divided by this thing here also. Okay. And if you do that, then it's easy to see that the trace of C, which is the trace of this guy here, well, that actually is exactly the same as this. So you just come down to trace one. So you can rewrite this as the soup over states, in fact, that is positive semi-definite matrices with trace one, and then C to the, A is C to the 1 over 2R. So you get this. Y and just get rid of that. Sorry. And then you get a C to the 1 over 2R tensor identity here. And then it's okay, so it's the P norm of that. So what are you doing? You're taking the pth power, you're taking the trace, and then taking the 1 over pth power of that. So that's just writing out explicitly what this thing is. Okay, so I'm still not saying that that's easy to evaluate, but it's just sort of an alternative way of writing it. And now we can use a very powerful inequality, which arose in Lieb and Turing's work on stability of matter. So the Lieb-Turing inequality. And this says that if you have a product of positive matrices this way, which we have, so we have this matrix times y times the same thing, so this is all self-adjoint, and we're taking the whole thing to the power of p, and p is bigger than 1, then the Lieb-Turing inequality says that that's always less than or equal to what you would get in commutative case, which is p over 2r tensor identity y to the p and p over 2r tensor identity. Okay, so you can just raise everything to the power of p and you'll get an upper bound. Okay, and since that's the identity there on the second factor, if I write this evaluate that as the inside trace there, what I have is trace 2 of y to the p on the inside this, and then I have the C to the P over R here on the outside. Okay, so that's just fooling around with that, and then from the definition of R, remember Q is bigger than P, so 1 over P is bigger than 1 over Q, so that equals that, and if we multiply by P, we get P over R plus P over Q equals 1. So that means that sort of R over P is the conjugate of the Q over P. Okay, so if I take the soup over, remember C, a positive semi-definite with the trace 1, and then I have C to the P over R times this positive matrix, trace 2 y to the p, then by sort of undoing this trick here, you know, sort of going backwards there, that's the same as the soup over trace B bigger than or equal to 0 of the trace of B times this. Okay, so I'm calling that B, and the condition on B now is that the Q over P norm of B the conjugate value, so the R over P norm of this is less than or equal to 1. Okay. And but just by the duality of the ordinary P norm, that then is the the conjugate value, which is the Q over P norm of this thing, and so if we write that out, that's the trace 2 of this thing, the Q over P, then I take the trace 1 to the P over Q. Okay, so finally, blah blah blah, work it back here, that's the inside there, take the 1 over P power, and I end up with the inequality that I stated, so this is less than or equal to this. Okay. So that's the proof for that particular case. As I said, it relies on a non-trivial matrix inequality, but matrix inequality just comes out of hands-on estimates, and there's no other structure needed for it. How tight is the bound? Well, the bound it gives an upper bound for the norm, but there's no comparable lower bound. So in particular, there's a sequence of matrices YK such that the PQ norm of YK divided by the expression here, so this thing goes to zero as K goes to infinity. So there's no lower bound for the PJ norm in terms of these things here. So just to finish up, this is significant because Carlin and Lieb were able to take this object here and turn it into a norm. Marius already explained how they do that, but let me just remind you again. So the Carlin and Lieb theorem is that for p between 1 and 2, for q bigger than or equal to 1, this map on the positive semi-definite matrices is a convex. So that's a very non-trivial result that had been open for a number of years, and they finally settled it. Once they had that, they showed how to extend this to a norm. And I should say, all of this is in Carlin and Lieb's paper, so we're not responsible for inventing this. First of all, if Y is a difference of positive semidefinite matrices, so it's self-adjoint, then they define a norm by taking the inf of this function here, which I'll call psi pq of Y. So take psi pq of Z, so psi pq of W, and take the inf over the decompositions of this, and it's easy to see that that gives a norm on the Hermitian ones, and then this can finally be extended to a general norm by taking a general matrix and putting it into a 2x2 block matrix, which this thing is Hermitian now, so you can apply this the definition here, and you get a norm out of this. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So this then is the Carolyn-Leib definition, and again, it works in this range of parameters only, and that's because the convexity theorem only works there. Convexity theorem is false if p is bigger than 2. So it's a it's a restricted norm, and it satisfies the Minkowski inequality, but for example, it does, you don't have a duality property. It doesn't have that nice structure of the Bézier norm. But let me get this. As a consequence of this, we can deduce that the Carolyn-Leib norm and the Bézier norm are inequivalent norms, at least for one particular case where P is 2. So Bézier norm and the Carolyn-Leib norm are inequivalent for P equals 2, Q bigger than or equal to 1. I'm sorry, Q bigger than 2. So just to finish up the natural way to extend the commutative version of this LQ of LP norm is with an expression like this, and that can indeed be turned into a norm using that procedure there and this theorem of Carol and Leib. I would say it's less or not. It turns out to be less natural than the Bézier norm, and less satisfactory. But it does give a bound, at least for the Bézier norm. And since the Bézier norm is, it's almost impossible to imagine how you would get how you would easily compute it. It's very useful to have a good bound for it. Okay, that's where I'm going to end.